Hi guys, and welcome back to my podcast, After Dark. My name is Allison, and like the title says, in this podcast we're going to be looking into some of the strange, crazy, and disturbing things people do after dark. This includes things like heists, robberies, murders, serial killers, and more, so if you're interested in stuff like that, stick around. In these cases, we're going to be looking at where, when, and why these crimes were committed, and if the case was ever solved, or if it remains a mystery to this day. Not sure when exactly this episode is going to be out. Hopefully it didn't take as long as the last one. But with that being said, let's get into today's long overdue episode. We're going to be covering Gary Michael Hilton, also known as the National Forest Serial Killer, and how one of his victims was able to stay alive for 3 days with him, and how her death ultimately led to his capture. Hope you enjoy. Gary was born on November 26, 1946 in Atlanta, Georgia. I couldn't find much on his childhood or his dad, but we do know his mother was pretty poor and she married Gary's stepdad, Nilo DeBag. Gary really did not like this though, and he ended up shooting his stepfather in 1959 when he was only 13 because he believed he was taking his mom like away from him. Nilo was only wounded and surprisingly didn't press charges, wanting to give Gary a second chance, so they sent him to a mental hospital. He was later released, and though his stepfather forgave him, Gary's mom didn't want him back in the house till he started school. I'm sure that was hard for him when he already believed Nilo was stealing his mom, and then now he hears that she doesn't even want him around. It must have been very tough. And I'm not saying he should have shot his stepfather, but I do think he has a lot of things going on psychologically. Despite this, he was still able to enlist in the military in 1963 when he was just 17, which I thought he had to be 18, but this was a while ago, so maybe the age to enlist was younger at the time, who knows. As a soldier in the U.S. Army, he was sent to West Germany as part of the Davy Crockett platoon. This platoon was responsible for the Davy Crockett missile, a nuclear device, and deploying it if necessary. And this is actually a really dangerous job, and it required a 5-man team consisting of a commander, gunner, assistant gunner, loader, and computer. And if done improperly, the missile could backfire and kill them, like, instantly, because it didn't have an abort function, which probably would have been a smart thing to add, but I guess they just did not think about that. After a few years of serving, Gary started to hear voices, and he was put into another mental hospital and diagnosed with schizophrenia, and then would be honorably discharged, leaving the army in 1967. And I would say keep the schizophrenia diagnosis in mind. It's not really mentioned in any of the sources I looked, and I won't be mentioning it a lot in the other sections, but I do think it's important to understand where he is mentally. Since Gary didn't start killing until he was a lot older, at least that we know of, there's a bit more information in this background section about him. So after leaving the military, he was married 3 times. First to Sue for 3 years in DeKalb County, Georgia, from 1969 to 1971, when they got divorced. The next was Dina Yvonne Baugh, also in DeKalb County. They got married on August 24th, 1977, and divorced in May of 1978. So a very short second marriage, only lasted about 9 months. And lastly, his third marriage was to Betty Sue Edwards Galloway on March 19th, 1979. She was a security officer in Atlanta's Stone Mountain Park, which, not sure if her job had anything to do with where Hilton would later kill, because he did kill in national parks, but they also ended up getting divorced on October 24th, 1979. And even after these 3 marriages, he still had no kids. He was on his own. He'd often go hiking with his dog Dandy in forests and mountains of the southern United States, and that is where he ended up killing a lot of his victims. Gary was friends with and a previous client of Samuel Rael, a lawyer and the producer of Deadly Run, an independent movie from 1995, and Gary actually helped come up with the plot of the movie, where a serial killer holds women captive in the woods, which doesn't really seem like just a coincidence that he would later go on to murder 4 people in the woods. He also couldn't keep a job down for a long time. He ended up moving a lot, That is a sign that a lot of serial killers present. They have trouble holding relationships and jobs. And then at the age of 54, though, he did finally get a job. He was a roofer in Atlanta, Georgia. So he got there eventually, after 54 years. In 2007, Gary decided to take a little road trip, hitting the road with his dog Dandy and heading to North Carolina in the Pisgah National Forest, which is where he first encountered John and Irene Bryant on October 21st, 2007. They were hiking when Hilton attacked them and killed Irene by blunt force. He then took John hostage and forced him to give up his ATM card and PIN number using violence and intimidation. John obviously gave that information up. I mean, he was 81 years old. I don't think he could have withstood much of Hilton's torture. And he also just saw his wife, who was 84 years old, get killed, which is obviously very devastating, I'm sure. And I wouldn't be surprised if he felt like there wasn't much to hang on to anymore. Irene's body would be found by authorities close to where they had parked their car that morning, and John was taken in Gary's van to Nathanael, I really pronounced that wrong, sorry, but Nathanael National Forest, which is about a 2 hour drive from where he was, and then he shot John in the head with a 22 caliber Magnum firearm. Next day at 7:37 p.m., Gary used the Bryant ATM card to take out $300 in Ducktown, Tennessee. Which, I mean, if you were gonna steal from people, I don't know why you wouldn't take more money than like $300. Like, I don't know, why not like 5,000? But who knows? Maybe he didn't want to be too suspicious, I guess, to the banks. Just a little over a month later, on December 1st, 2007, Cheryl Hodges Dunlap disappeared in, and I'm also going to pronounce this one wrong, Apalachicola National Forest. I feel so stupid pronouncing these names. But that's also the largest national forest in Florida with 632,890 acres when she was just 46 years old. And I really never understood how big acres are, so 632,890 acres is the same as around 100,000 square miles. Cheryl was a nurse in the Student Healthcare Center at Florida State University and also a member of the Evangelical Christian River of Life Church. And when she didn't show up to church on Sunday, where she taught a Sunday school class, people started to get suspicious, and then they became even more worried when she didn't show up to work the next morning on Monday. I'm not sure if Cheryl had a husband or not, but she did have two sons who were grown at the time, which might be why she wasn't reported missing until a few days later on December 3rd, just because there was maybe she lived alone. I'm sure her sons were probably grown in their own places, and if she didn't have a husband, I guess people didn't notice her missing for a bit. But the next day, her car was found abandoned on Crawfordville Highway with a flat tire, and some people believe that she was trying to flag someone down for help when Hilton came across her. The 3 days following her disappearance, a man who is almost positively Hilton was seen on bank cameras attempting to use Cheryl's ATM card and withdraw money. I say it's almost positively him because the man was wearing gloves, a hat, and what looks to be like a rubber mask in order to hide his identity. Because, I mean, that's not suspicious at all. I mean, when there were other bank customers around or just like regular pedestrians and they saw a man obviously like in disguise trying to withdraw money. Like someone would think that's weird and report it. Like just go with the classic sunglasses and hat and like a jacket with a high collar if you're like trying to hide. Like yeah, you're just putting too much effort in there. But detectives would continue to surveil this bank and the ATM for a week after Hilton withdrew money first, but he never ended up going back there, so they didn't catch him. On Saturday, December 8th, a search party was put together with 180 people scouring the woods by Cheryl's abandoned car, obviously searching for her, but they did not find anything. Cheryl's body wouldn't actually be found until 2 weeks after her disappearance when hunters in the park noticed a group of buzzards pecking over a body. When they went closer, they saw that Hilton had cut off Cheryl's head and hands to make her less identifiable. There's a bit of controversy about what actually happened to Cheryl Dunlap, because later, after Hilton had been caught, prosecutors in court would say that he abducted her when she was reading a book at the Leon Sings Geological Area, and then he held her captive for 2 days and stole her car, a white Toyota Camry, and withdrew money from her bank accounts. Then after he got her money, he decapitated her and cut off her hands before burning them, leaving her body in the forest for the hikers mentioned earlier to find and report. So I'm not completely sure what happened. Obviously, I was not there, but I am more inclined to believe the lawyers. So my interpretation would be she was kidnapped while reading, and he stole her car and left it on the side of the road, giving it a flat tire to throw off authorities from what actually happened. He then held her captive, forcing her to give up her bank information, which he then used to withdraw money before killing her and cutting off her hands and head. The murder that Gary Michael Hilton is probably most known for is that of Meredith Emerson. Meredith was born in South Carolina, but would later move to North Carolina, then Colorado with her family. She attended the University of Georgia, pursuing a degree in French and earning the Cecil Wilcox Award for Excellence in French. She would continue living in Georgia, specifically Beaufort, Georgia, with her dog Ella and a roommate. She had left on January 1st, 2008 to hike Blood Mountain in the Chattahoochee National Forest, leaving a note for her roommate on the chalkboard they had saying, "Taking Ella hiking, hope you had fun." When Meredith didn't show up for her job the next day is when her friends and boyfriend started to become worried. They looked through her hiking books and searched some of the trails that she had marked, eventually finding her car parked at the trailhead to Blood Mountain. Blood Mountain has an elevation of 4,458 feet, making it the sixth tallest mountain in Georgia, but the highest peak on the Georgia section of the Appalachian Trail. It's located within the boundaries of Chattahoochee National Forest and the Blood Mountain Wilderness, and I can't help but not point out the irony in the mountain's name, which I'm sure you guys have already picked up on it already, but I guess if a murderer was gonna kill someone anywhere, like, Blood Mountain would be a fitting place. We're almost positive that Hilton came across Meredith while walking on the trail with his own dog, Dandy, and used that to strike up a conversation. There are witnesses who claim to have seen her with an older man on the spur trail. Another hiker on the trail, Seth Blankenship, an ex-cop, had come along the trail Meredith and Hilton were on a little bit after them, noticing that it looked like a fight had happened, seeing water bottles, a dog leash, woman's hair clip, and a police baton just kind of scattered all around the area. A fight had, in fact, happened. Hilton had attacked Meredith Emerson with a knife, but he was kind of unaware of just how hard she would fight back. Meredith was a blue belt in Kyukido, a form of martial arts, teaching self-defense, confidence, discipline, and physical fitness. And it also incorporates techniques and elements from kind of other fighting styles like taekwondo, jiu-jitsu, karate, wrestling, and more. So she studied at AFK Athens in Georgia, and it was safe to say that she put up a good fight against Hilton, but was ultimately overpowered because along with the knife, he also wielded a police baton, but left it behind for Seth to find later. Seth also remembered that a couple minutes before he had come across the ruined trail, he had seen a toothless elderly man with a baton walking near a young woman and carrying a leash, and he just kind of mistakenly assumed that they were father and daughter, but he became very suspicious knowing that something was wrong, and he voiced his concerns to Bill Clausen, who was also hiking that day with his son and fiancé. The men noticed a scruffy-looking man in the woods who was seemingly waiting impatiently for them to leave. And they did in fact leave, walking back to where they had seen the pair previously, but coming up empty-handed. Seth had continued searching till the sun went down, and Bill left the abandoned items at a local store, but none of them ever called the police with their concerns, and, you know, maybe if they had, Meredith would still be alive today. Who knows? Emergency services had started the search for Meredith after she had been reporting missing on January 2nd. That evening, they asked the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, which aids the justice system in criminal investigation, forensics, and computerized criminal justice information, for help. They put the story of Meredith's disappearance on the TV, and Bill Clausen, the hiker from the day before, saw the news and called the police with all the information he had. But, you know, he didn't call the police right away, I guess, when he found this stuff, but I guess the next day is better than not calling at all. On January 3rd, a press conference was held announcing the main suspect as a man hiking with his dog, and I'm sure they included a description from Clausen. John Tabor, who had been watching CNN before his lunch and listening to this story, realized that he knew the suspect. He had actually employed Hilton to do marketing for his house sighting business. And then Tabor called the police, and after being interviewed by them, he gave the make of Hilton's car, a white Chevrolet Astro van, and the tag number on it. But only 2 hours after this phone call with the police took place, Hilton actually called Tabor, first from a cell phone and then from a payphone a few minutes later. And when Tabor picked up, he was asked to write a check for Hilton and then leave it at his business in DeKalb County for him to go pick up. And for some reason, I do not know what was going through his mind here, but John Tabor did not tell the police about this phone call right away. He only told them when an officer called to follow up with him later. I think if that officer hadn't called, Tabor probably wouldn't have said anything. He cited fear as his reason not to call, but when he first heard the story of Meredith's kidnapping, he had no trouble calling and giving up information on Hilton then, so I don't really know how this was any different. But Hilton never showed up to collect that check. And that night, authorities released his name and picture for the news to broadcast. Meredith survived for almost 72 hours while she was with Hilton. He, of course, wanted to withdraw money from her account, but each time he tried, she would give him fake PIN numbers, which in turn caused a record of all the failed attempts and locations of the ATMs he used. And I mean, props to this girl, like, she was really brave. Firstly, trying to fight him off when he initially attacked her, but then surviving for multiple days as his hostage and refusing to give her real information. On January 4th, 3 days after Meredith was originally attacked, a lawn care truck kind of got stuck near this river where Hilton was camped and holding Meredith. And then Michael Andrew, the driver of this truck who was obviously stuck in the river, I mean, he went to go ask Hilton for help, and Hilton kind of jumped out of the truck almost as if trying to keep Andrews away from the van. Which he obviously noted that, and then when Hilton learned that Michael Andrews had called the police to help recover the truck, he just packed up his van and left really quickly, which, you know, was not suspicious at all, but whatever. After multiple failed attempts at retrieving her money, Hilton took Meredith back to the forest and he bludgeoned her to death and then decapitated her. On January 4th, 2008. Ella and Meredith's dog was with them this whole time, and surprisingly, Hilton let the dog go unharmed after killing Meredith. So, I don't know. Maybe that counts for something, but you know, it, not really. He did have a dog of his own that he had had for a while, so maybe he was a dog person and couldn't bear killing one. Who knows? Well, Meredith was extremely smart, and basically created a trail of evidence for the police to follow with her bank transactions. They sadly didn't get her records until it was too late. The very same day he killed Meredith, a witness saw Hilton trying to clean out his van at a gas station. A witness called police, who quickly came and arrested Hilton before he could bleach the inside of his van, making crime scene analysts able to match Meredith Emerson's DNA to the blood inside the van. He would later lead investigators to the body and said, "It was hard, you know. You gotta remember we had spent several good days together." Which I find disgusting. I'm pretty sure those were not good days at all for her after he kidnapped her and tried to force her banking information out of her for 4 days. And then when she didn't give in, he killed her very brutally by beating her to death. Like, that takes a long time and is very hands-on. It's a more personal way to kill than just shooting her. So I do not think for one moment that he had any remorse killing Meredith Emerson, and honestly, he probably enjoyed it. On January 30th, 2008, Hilton pleaded guilty to the murder of Meredith Emerson. For that, he was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole in 30 years. So by now, he'll be like about halfway through those 30 years. Hopefully, he won't be getting out anytime soon. There was a possibility of the death sentence for Meredith's murder, but the prosecution agreed to waive that if Hilton led them to her body, which we know he in fact did do. After this, he was linked to the other three murders of Cheryl Dunlap and the Bryant couple. In 2011, he was tried for Cheryl Dunlap's murder and given the death sentence. Then a year later, in 2012, Hilton pleaded guilty to the kidnapping and murder of the Bryants and sentenced life in prison. I think all of these sentences happened in three different states, Florida, North Carolina, and Georgia, just because of where the murders took place. He did cross state lines, but I'm pretty sure he's serving his time in Florida because that is where he was convicted and sentenced to death, which was the most severe out of all of his sentences. In an article published on September 9th this year, Hilton and his lawyer went back to the Florida Supreme Court to try and get rid of his death penalty. His lawyer, Robert A. Morris, argued in court that Hilton was denied the right of effective counsel during his 2011 trial because his defense team had a really high turnover in cases and his lawyers were unable to communicate with each other. And like, damn, and Robert's just, he's roasting all those lawyers. He continued to outline all the mistakes of Hilton's previous defense in the trial, stating that they decided to not use eyewitness accounts of abuse in his childhood and mental illness to argue mitigating factors for jurors to consider in deciding on the death sentence or not. And going along with the mental illness argument, he believes that the courts didn't put enough consideration into Hilton's schizophrenia diagnosis, which caused him to be discharged from the military and it would make him ineligible for the death penalty. And which, I mean, I'm not sure how severe his schizophrenia was. He did say that in the army he started hearing voices, but then it's never mentioned later, and I'm not sure if it had a part in his killings or not, or like what exactly the effect the schizophrenia had on Hilton. But I don't think we'll ever really know. In a quote from Robert, he said, "There is reasonable probability that, but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the results of the proceedings would have been different." The Assistant Attorney General, Michael Kennett, argued against this, though, saying that Hilton's previous lawyers were told to focus on getting a life sentence and avoiding the death penalty, and that they planned their defense around this idea. He also countered Robert's idea of using eyewitnesses to Hilton's abuse by saying it was a strategic decision on their part to use expert testimony, and it was thought out beforehand. Robert countered this by saying that the defense just, they had no strategy at all, and they couldn't communicate with each other, even calling them dysfunctional. But it was again brought up that Hilton had an active part in forming his defense strategy, so any of the decisions they made were also made in part by Hilton himself. I don't think a decision has been made on whether to reverse the death penalty or not. It did not say in the article, but Hilton is quoted by saying, "I want to take this to trial and I want to waste the state's money if they're going to put me to death." So, I mean, obviously he doesn't think he deserves to die or just doesn't want to, but I mean, who doesn't really? I think any criminal would try to appeal and get the ruling changed to a life sentence rather than the death penalty if they could. There's also three other people that Hilton is suspected of killing, the first being Rosanna Miliani, who disappeared on December 7, 2005 at the age of 26. Rosanna suffered from bipolar disorder and was last seen in a convenience store with an older man in Bryson City, North Carolina. The cashier working that night remembers that they bought either a sleeping bag or a hiking bag, and that the man with Rosanna claimed to be a preacher who went around the campsites near and on the Appalachian Trail. The cashier also noticed that Rosanna looked nervous the whole time, and that would be the last moment she was seen alive. 2 years later, that same clerk called the police to say he believed it was Gary Hilton with Rosanna that night. Rosanna's father was also convinced that it was Hilton who killed her. He also said that she would call him every night to check in, and the day before her disappearance, she called from a Cherokee Ramada Inn after taking a bus from Florida to North Carolina, saying she wanted to hike the Appalachian Trail, which was one of Hilton's hunting grounds. Next murder Hilton is suspected of having committed is that of Michael Scott Lewis, manager of Dunder Mifflin Paper Company. Just kidding, hopefully you guys all got that reference. You know, Michael Scott office, whatever. But anyways, Michael was 27 and lived in South Dayton. On December 6, 2007, his torso and legs were found in black trash bags on the banks of Tomoka River inside Tomoka State Park. But curiously, his head was never found. It does seem likely Hilton was the murderer because that was kind of his MO, decapitating his victims. And if it was in fact Hilton, that would put the murder of Michael Lewis just days after that of Cheryl Dunlap, which is not much of a cooling off period, but who knows. They found Michael's car at his apartment complex with the keys still in the ignition, but the car was considerably far from his actual apartment. And speaking from experience, most people usually park right outside of their place if they can, not a football field's lengths away. Inside his car were two guitars and unwashed laundry, so he's obviously not expecting this to happen, but then again, what murder victim expects that they're about to be killed? The last person he's suspected of killing is also his first possible kill. I don't know why I said that was a weird first possible kill. On September 7th, 1977, hunters in North Carolina's Pigsa National Forest came across a scattering of bones, clothes, and other items near a campsite in sort of like a shallow grave. From the bones alone, investigators were able to tell that the victim was a woman around the age of 40 to 55 years old with an arthritic knee. With this information and dental records, it actually led to the identification of the bones belonging to Judy Smith, a 50-year-old nurse from Massachusetts. She was last seen alive by her husband 5 months earlier, who had reported her missing when she never came home from a day of sightseeing in Philadelphia. It's unclear to detectives how Judy ended up in North Carolina, 600 miles away from where she was in Philadelphia, and she was found wearing clothes that were, you know, better suited for hiking, kind of more athletic than the clothes she had been wearing on the last day of her sightseeing and when anyone had seen her last. But the main reason it's thought Hilton also killed Judy Smith along with his other victims is because John and Irene Bryant were left in a very nearby location to where Judy's bones were found. So this was possibly the murder that started Hilton off in his killing spree, or maybe there were earlier murders that we still haven't connected him to. We really don't know. It's believed that Hilton is most likely responsible for all three of these killings, but there was never any concrete evidence to connect him to the crimes, and he never confessed to them, so he still hasn't been charged for them, if it was even him or not. That's about all I have for you guys with the case of Gary Michael Hilton, the National Forest serial killer. I hope you guys found it interesting. It actually worked out well for me because I did a project on him for school and used some of that research for this podcast. And I was able to get it out a little bit sooner than the last one. It's still kind of hard to manage everything that I have going on, but I'm doing my best. The information I used in this episode was taken from strangeoutdoors.com, Murderpedia, Wikipedia, Tallahassee.com, ThoughtCo, BlueRidgeNow.com, and a PDF from radford.edu. If you like this episode, these sources cover a lot of other true crime stories and other topics, and I highly recommend you guys check them out if you want to. Once again, thank you for listening to my podcast, After Dark. My name is Allison, and I hope you all have a great day, and I will see you in the next episode. Bye.